Happy New Year, everybody. 15 and 60 edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast Eastern Conference, going Atlanta Hawks through Washington Wizards. A lot of interesting stuff to discuss in terms of some trade rumors, also some teams making moves for better or worse in the standings. Sponsored today by Blue Apron. BlueApron.com/capspace is the URL to get started with them. Three free meals, your first three meals free with them, with free shipping at that BlueApron.com/capspace URL. And then also Betterment as well. Sophisticated investing and financial advice, all at a lower cost than more traditional financial services. Betterment.com/capspace. That's how you get started with them. I think the place to start here, Danny, is the Atlanta Hawks, and not only because their name starts with an A.
They are the buzzy team, we can call it in that way. We'll start with the fundamentals before we get into the juicy stuff. They're 18-16, 6-4 since last time we did this, 22nd in offense, 5th in defense, currently have a 62% chance of making the playoffs per 538, and 538 projects them to finish 6th in the East, which would put them at 40 wins.
Yeah, you'll recall they had basically that awful stretch the last time we looked at them, where they started, I think, 9-2. Then they got back to 500 by losing, like, you know, 8 out of 10, 9 out of 10, something like that, part of which coincided with the West Coast trip and Paul Millsap being out. And they've righted the ship to some degree now, playing about 500 ball, had a nice win today over the Spurs. And that was really an interesting game in a number of levels. Obviously, anytime Pop matches up with one of his old proteges, this is the first time that Atlanta had actually beaten them, helped by a Tim Hardaway Jr. jump shot to tie it from three as they were down three in the waning seconds. He came off a stagger double. Mike Muscala basically tackled the guy who was guarding him, Manu Ginobili, to prevent Manu from switching off onto Hardaway. Kawhi Leonard didn't switch out either, and Atlanta actually benefited from Kawhi sitting out most of the end of the game. He'd been recovering from an illness, but then for whatever reason played the overtime, and then Kawhi actually missed what would have been the last shot that I think could have won the game for the Spurs, stopped by Paul Millsap. But it was a nice win for Atlanta. Anytime you're going to beat the Spurs, even if they are a little bit limited, and a nice comeback. But one of the other things that I took away from this one is guys really don't seem to be enjoying playing with Dennis Schroeder right now. Dwight Howard in particular just didn't get a touch. And you know, we don't think Howard needs to post up or anything, but just didn't get a touch in the last probably 5 minutes of this game, I want to say. And then finally in the overtime, Schroeder, who had been looking for his own shot most of the time, throws this ridiculous alley-oop to Dwight that he goes for and ends up committing a foul. And Schroeder tries to talk to him after, and Dwight just looks at him like, you're finally going to throw me a pass, and that's the ridiculous pass that you're going to throw me?
It's a challenging situation because Schroeder just hasn't had that kind of responsibility of being the orchestrator of an offense with other pieces. And he had that one pass to Millsap late that was pretty good. But other than that, it was a lot of looking for himself. And part of that in this game is justifiable because the primary players that the Spurs had on those pick and rolls late were Tony Parker and Pau Gasol. So Schroeder can look for himself, but you still have to make sure everyone else is happy.
So let's get to the talk about Millsap now. Three reports of note today started with a tweet from Chris Haynes noting that Millsap is looking to opt out at the end of the season to become an unrestricted free agent. Recall that he signed a 2+1, making a little over $20 million a year back in the summer of 2015, and that he, of course, can opt out. He will be 32 this offseason. This kind of seems to be the new tactic short of asking for a trade. You know, we saw, for example, Rudy Gay say that he was certainly going to opt out in Sacramento. That got leaked. The next report was Mark Stein and Brian Windhorst saying that the Hawks are now open to offers on Millsap and their other free agents, Tabo Sefolosha and Kyle Korver. You know, that doesn't mean that they are dead set on moving them, but they are open to offers. And then Chris Fillmore, the local writer, noted that he was told by a source that Millsap has not made up his mind about opting out, and there have been no discussions on that. It's kind of funny how you'll see this a little bit. It happened with the Bulls too, where there'll be a report from a national reporter, and then the team, in their kind of spin control attempt, will leak the way they want it to sound to the local reporter. I'm not saying I know for sure that that's what happened here, but that happened in Chicago with these Hoiberg on the hot seat rumors that seemed like it happened here. What's your reaction to all this, Danny?
It is not a surprise in the least that Millsap is intending on opting out, whether it's made public or not. He, beyond the fact that he can probably make more per season or even next season than he would have under the option. The security of getting your last big contract is totally worth it. Like, it's what he should do. So that part of it isn't news. Of course, the Hawks being willing to move him, should they actually be willing to do so, is real news, because Paul Millsap at his present stage would be one of the best players. I'm not talking about prospects or future assets or anything like that. He'd be one of the best players to move at a trade deadline in recent years. And that has been, you know, there are, of course, other examples of good players moving, but also the specific nature of it with bird rights and him being a free agent at the end of the season makes it a substantially more complicated negotiation and far more interesting for people like us.
Yeah, we'll look at it from Millsap's camp's perspective first. Why would you leak that? Well, maybe it doesn't mean that he necessarily wants to leave Atlanta for sure, but he does want to get paid. And he knows what happened with Al Horford. The Hawks also know what happened with Al Horford. That was one of the things cited by Mark Stein, and that they lost Horford for nothing, and they don't want to do that with Millsap, or to a lesser extent, Korver or Cephalosha. For Millsap, if you make it clear that you're opting out, you're basically saying, all right, if you're not going to pay me, Atlanta, you better move me, because what you want to do is have as many options open as you can. You would like to be traded somewhere that you would like to stay, and so you have the option of staying there, or you can still go as well if you would like to. If Atlanta is not going to meet your price, better to know that now and be traded somewhere else. And also, you know, it looks like this Atlanta team, maybe they could improve as they did down the end of last year and get into maybe being, you know, like the sixth seed or fifth seed in the East. I don't see them catching Charlotte for fourth. This is not a championship contender. They're not going to beat Cleveland this year. So their defense, after a great start early, is regressed to, you know, the lower end of the top 10. There's nothing really too special about this team at this point. The thing that's really interesting to me about Millsap, you touched on this, was what is he really worth? It's difficult to find a historical analog to a player like him, a guy who's on the fringes of all NBA consideration. Last year, you know, was probably a guy who was the 15th, 20th best player in the league or so, but older as well, going to be a free agent. The closest thing that I could come up to is a guy who was traded under these circumstances about kind of Millsap's stature in the league was Rasheed Wallace back in 2004, who was moved first to the Hawks from the Blazers and then oddly a week later to Detroit. Now remember, Wallace, probably his stature at that time might have actually been lower than where Millsap's was, even though he was 29, because he'd had a lot of attitude problems. He was getting, you know, he back when there wasn't a limit on technicals, he would get like 30 technicals a year. He was part of that Jailblazers group that really turned off their fan base. And he ended up having a very, very nice career in Detroit, as we know. And he was 29 at the time, so that's younger than Millsap is going to be. He ended up getting traded for what became the 17th pick in the draft, a Milwaukee pick that Detroit owned that actually became Josh Smith in the 2004 draft. And then also Detroit traded their own pick, which was pretty late, to Boston as a sweetener for taking on a bunch of salary flotsam to make the deal work. I think that Millsap's value would be a little bit higher than what we're talking about with Rasheed, because, and you get into some of these other guys who are in that situation, they were younger, you know, probably just better players, you know, had more years left than Millsap.
The other analog, it's not even as close as Rasheed that I thought of, was Dikembe Mutombo. Mutombo was 34 when he got traded to the Sixers, won defensive player of the year that year, was a big part of their success, and then re-signed there as a free agent. And the re-signing part of this is fascinating, because Millsap has a clear incentive to go to a team that he would be willing to re-sign to. So there's a lot of information that needs to transfer from party to party here. And that's part of what agents do, you know, is to make sure that that goes. And it also makes him, if that information comes through in a good way, much more valuable to a team like, let's say, Toronto, who will not have cap space this summer, because assuming they re-sign Kyle Lowry, and they would not be able to add somebody like Paul Millsap. Now, can those two come together on a value? Can those two come together on a price? That's harder to know. And Millsap, depending on how this cap turns out in terms of all the holds and everything and where the actual number gets set, he might actually have more options as a trade recipient than as a free agent, because this isn't a great group of teams that are going to be available as a free agent. So maybe he can massage himself to a destination that is better than he could sign with this summer.
Yeah, that's a great way of looking at it also. All right, we'll move on from Atlanta here. I'm sure we're going to be talking a lot about this. I mean, we didn't even get into what Korver or Cephalosha could theoretically fetch or where you go from here if you're Atlanta. If you do move those guys, you're now really taking a step back into the lottery, most likely. Can that market handle it? Does it matter because you're probably headed towards the lottery anyway with this core? Could they even look to move Dwight Howard? What would his trade value be? All that is really pretty fascinating stuff. But we'll have to save that for another time. We will get to the Boston Celtics momentarily. But first, let's talk about Blue Apron. Dang, I actually, usually the way to work with these podcast advertising is they'll send you a free sample at the beginning. And Blue Apron did that with me. But I actually have continued to subscribe to their service, especially now that my girlfriend is back from spending a month away. And we made a couple of great meals last week. We had a roast beef on Christmas Eve, which was outstanding, and also a crispy chicken with sweet potatoes that we really enjoyed as well. Blue Apron is basically a food delivery service that delivers incredible, fresh, high-quality ingredients to your door, way cheaper than you would get those ingredients at a place like a Whole Foods or something. And they also measure out each portion perfectly so that there's no food waste, which I think is really good as well. That's an underrated problem with buying stuff at the grocery store, is stuff always ends up going bad or buy too much of it. And, you know, I mean, like, cilantro is one of those things. Like, have you ever used all the cilantro that you bought at the store, Danny? I think I've used like 1% of it every single time.
I'm not much of a cilantro enthusiast, but I definitely have not.
Are you one of the people that, like, it tastes like soap? You have like the genetic thing?
No, I just don't think it adds much for me, but I understand that other people like it. So I've even cooked with it. I just don't enjoy it that much myself.
All right, we are getting sidetracked here. If you want to get started with Blue Apron, blueapron.com/capspace is the URL to do so. You can get your first three meals free with them by going to that URL, which is easy to remember because we talk about it all the time on the program, Capspace, blueapron.com/capspace. Great way to try out the service and also let them know that you came from us. Support the program. All right, let's move on to Boston. Where are they at?
They are 20-14, 7-3 since the last time we did this. 7th in offense, 18th in defense, 99% chance of making the playoffs, 4% actually getting the first seed in the East, 2% title, and 538 has them at 3rd in the East with 50 wins. Honestly, to me, this feels like their destiny. They're the third seed. If we wonder whether they're going to beat the two, assuming the two is Toronto, if it ends up being Cleveland, then we kind of know where this is going. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but we're just kind of waiting for that series.
Yeah, I think that's right. If you were going to see that they were seventh in offense, especially with some of the injuries that they had, I think that's something that internally they would have been very, very pleased by. And the reason they're seventh in offense, we'll get to their defense in a second, but it's really just been all Isaiah Thomas. I mean, Isaiah Thomas has been very under the radar. That's been something he's been cursed with his entire career. But this is just a ridiculous season that he's having. 61% true shooting, 34% usage. He's scoring 28 a game. Getting to the foul line for 9 free throw attempts a game, 28 a game in only 34 minutes, by the way. In that level of efficiency is completely ridiculous. Compared to last year, he's just really bumped it up a notch in just about every area. He's taking more threes, hitting a very slightly higher percentage, but way more free throws. He's taking 9.7 free throw attempts per 36 minutes as opposed to 7.4 last year. And then the three-pointers, he's taking 7.8 threes per 36 minutes instead of 6.4 last year. And not only does he get fouled a lot, but he takes 34% of his shots as layups at the rim and 38% as threes. That's how you get that ridiculous usage and that ridiculous efficiency. I mean, that is just absolute superstar level of offensive production from Isaiah Thomas so far this year.
There is always a threshold, or usually there are some exceptions, that the best of the best between usage and efficiency, and Thomas is bursting through that a little bit. And it's even more impressive when you consider that for the most part, he is the sole playmaker in a lot of those Boston lineups. You know, Avery Bradley can do a little bit. Some of the other guys are capable, like they can make good passes, but he has to initiate a lot. And I've been super impressed that he's been able to build an offense that is his own success, but also other people's success. And I legitimately didn't think that he could pull off that double.
Avery Bradley, whom you mentioned, another very solid season from him. He's taken a step forward in most areas as well. One of those, which is his defensive rebounding. Defensive glass, a big problem for the Celtics overall, but he's improved from 7.3% of defensive rebounds to 18.8% this year. Pretty incredible. Wow. I can't remember the last time someone just decided, all right, I'm going to rebound more, but that's what he's been doing. Defensive glass, still a problem for these guys, though. And Al Horford is a wonderful defensive player, but not a wonderful defensive rebounder. Kelly Olynyk, not really a solution there either. Tyler Zeller is one of the softest bigs in the league. He's really been awful all year. I think he's regressed a little bit from when he was starting and actually a key piece of this team 2 years ago. Amir Johnson is looking like he's, you know, ready to move into a bench role at this point, although he still starts. And even when you have a guy like Marcus Smart, yeah, he's a good rebounder for a point guard, but he plays the three a lot on this team even too, alongside guys like Thomas and Bradley. You have Crowder playing at the four. Again, these are tough guys. They try hard, but sometimes size and athleticism, you're going to need that. And at this moment, they are now last in defensive rebound percentage, quite a decline even from last year when they were 26th. And that's even worse because the league as a whole continues to offensive rebound less every year.
And that's what makes it so catastrophic in some ways for them. I mean, they can still put together a solid defense around it, but teams aren't pressing that much on the offensive glass, and they're still getting a ton of them against the Celtics, and teams are aware of this and are pushing that advantage. And last year, one of the big ways that Boston offset that was by forcing an ungodly amount of turnovers. They forced turnovers on 14.6% of possessions, which was good for fourth in the league. They're still above average, but when you move from elite to pretty good, that takes away, it's a difference of 1.5% of all possessions, and that makes it a lot harder.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, each one of those possessions, if you have 100 possessions a game, that's 1.5 less turnovers you're getting. That's 1.5 more points that you're allowing, if you consider that, you know, you average about a point per possession a lot on defense. They also are not forcing misses as well as they had. I think part of that is simply due to the fact that Crowder and Horford missed some time. Since those guys have returned, they've been better up until they got eviscerated by Cleveland the other night. But they've gone from allowing field goal percentage of 48.7% up to 50.2% this year, a decline from 8th to 10th, with offense, of course, being up a little bit more overall this season.
Is there anything else? Do you want to talk about the whole Gerald Green, Jaylen Brown thing, or do you want to save that for another time?
Well, I think it's part of it too has been Terry Rozier that Green has been playing more over as well. Rozier has been largely out of the rotation these last few games. They have gone with Smart at the point. It started in a game at New York, I think the Christmas game, in which they used Smart at point guard because they wanted to have him take advantage of Brandon Jennings in the post, which he did to some effect. And then Smart in that game against Cleveland helped bring them back with some really nice pick and roll operation as well. So I think it's good for them. They've got Rozier 2 more years. Smart, someone who is going to need an extension after this season as a 2014 draftee, or not need an extension, but will be eligible for one. And so getting a good idea of what he can really do as the primary impetus on that second unit has been useful. And I think in terms of his playmaking, he has been outstanding. His finishing, his shooting, of course, are more works in progress still.
Yeah, that all seems fair. I don't think I need to add much to that. You ready to move on to Brooklyn?
Yeah, where they at?
They are a bristling 8-24, 2-8 since the last time we did this, and in many ways they're just kind of a generic bad team. 27th in offense, 28th in defense, and they actually changed with that Raptors game. They are now projected to finish tied with the Sixers at 22 wins for last in the East.
Yeah, and their over-under was like 20.5, so hopefully they're still on track. Jeremy Lin suffered that hamstring injury, which we talked about in news on the last program, but I don't think it's known yet when he is going to return. When he doesn't play, they just can't create anything on offense whatsoever. I don't really see them as active in the trade market. Maybe you'd see someone like a Randy Foy as a potential veteran buyout candidate on this team, but not a ton to talk about, I think, with transactions from these guys. Probably the most interesting thing do you have anything else on these guys, or should I just do my like Caris LeVert scouting report?
I floated the idea in my own brain for a second of them being a potential Rondo destination, just because they don't have anything else to do, but the partial guarantee for next year might scuttle that.
Yeah, that would be interesting. I forget how low they are in relation to the salary floor now, that they might be interested in taking out money, perhaps with a little bit of a sweetener to absorb that $3 million for next year, since Chicago presumably will be trying to use cap space. But the most interesting thing so far has been the debut of Caris LeVert, traded from Indiana as the 20th pick on draft night for Thad Young. LeVert, the scouting report out of Michigan on him was a guy who's 6'6", shoots it pretty well, but also is able to do some things off the dribble, operate a little bit in pick and roll, find shooters, decent athlete. I think what I've liked the most about just watching him, and there haven't been enough stats really, you know, he's been playing for 8-9 games now or so, and not getting a few rotation minutes, but not a ton. I really have liked his first step. He has not really been asked to put the ball in his hands very much. He'll get a few handoffs where he's actually comfortable shooting the three if the D goes under on, you know, a dribble handoff on the wing. But his first step in a closeout advantage situation, I've been impressed by. He gets into the lane relatively well. The biggest limitation I see for him is he's not an explosive athlete at the basket. You know, he can get to the rim off of one foot, but he doesn't have a ton of craft. He's not going over guys. He's not really going around guys when he's finishing. But you see what they saw in Caris LeVert, who obviously dropped too because he had this foot injury that took him so long to get back from. He's got a little pop off the drill. I mean, if think of him as maybe kind of like an Archie Goodwin who could shoot. Maybe that's like what he could be someday. You know, he's real thin. Again, not much vertical explosion, but he's the kind of guy who can drive on a closeout, hopefully make the shot when they leave him open. And if not, he can drive and then kick to the next player. You know, probably more useful there than as, you know, a guy who's going to really get to the rim and finish. But you hope he has some defensive potential as well. So I liked just little flashes from him as far as his ability to drive to the basket is pretty decent. You know, he's been totally inefficient so far. Hasn't shot it well. Looks comfortable shooting it, though. So I'm not going to say this guy's going to be some superstar, but at least you see something from him, which is more than you can say about some guys drafted in that range.
We freak out a lot, for justifiable reasons, about guys not being able to create separation. It's more of an issue with point guards, but it's always nice when you have somebody who looks like they can do that early on. And LeVert, you know, has missed a bunch of time in his Michigan career and in the NBA due to injuries. And so he'll need more than that. Like, that's not enough, especially if you're off ball more of the time to make it work, but it's a nice place to start.
All right. That fulfills our obligation to discuss the Brooklyn Nets today. Let's move on to the Charlotte Hornets.
Hornets 19-15, 5-5 since last time we did this, 14th in offense, 6th in defense, 89% chance of making the playoffs per 538, who also puts them 4th in the East with 44 wins.
Is this clearly the 4th best team in the East to you by the end of the year, or you think anybody could challenge them?
Can is a strong word, but I don't expect it. I think that they'll settle in as long as they stay, you know, marginally healthy relative to everybody else. They're consistent. They have defense that can carry them. And even if Kemba's insane start is not replicable for the rest of the season, they have enough.
One of the things that we talked about them from a cap management standpoint was Courtney Lee's cap hold was about $9 million. Rather than re-sign him to the contract that he got in New York, you know, who knows, maybe he wanted to go to New York anyway, but matching that offer, there was never even talk of really that they gave him much of an offer. That's all it would have taken. Instead, they traded for Marco Bellinelli, which subtracted $6 million from their cap space. They used $5 million on Roy Hibbert, and then they used, what, like $6 million or so or something on Ramon Sessions. Would you have rather retained Lee than brought in Bellinelli and Hibbert? Even though, when you consider Lee was, what, 30, 31, would have had a four-year contract.
The money, the years on that would have been a little bit scary, but it's not like they have payroll flexibility in the first place. And also, since they gave up a first for Bellinelli, theoretically they would have kept that. Probably wouldn't have been a player immediately, but it's another flyer. And when you have limited salary flexibility, you need all that you can. And they're getting not much from Hibbert. Bellinelli's having a solid year, so it's not like it's some super obvious decision, but I would have taken Lee.
I think that's probably, and then, you know, he could move into a bench role. Bellinelli has shot it well. As more of a dependent player, he works better in a system. But their defense really has been excellent when they're with the starters. Cody Zeller has by far the best net rating on the team, 9.0. And when he's on the floor, they give up 100.8 defensive rating. That's basically first in the league level of stuff. And Zeller also by far their best offensive center because he's really the only guy on this team who can like dive to the rim and finish a pick and roll. We've lamented many a time that Hibbert is incapable of doing that. And Hibbert now really is at the point where he's so slow, same thing with Hawes, that they're not necessarily quality defensive players. And then you look at some of the defense on the second unit, you've got Sessions, never a guy who defended much. Bellinelli, he'll try if he's in the right circumstance, but not a guy with much in the way of skill. Frank Kaminsky, again, another guy you look at as a relative liability. And then Hawes and Hibbert, it's amazing that they can stop anybody on the second unit, and they do miss some of that depth. The only really guy coming off their bench who is they've played well with him on the floor is Jeremy Lamb, continuing a trend where, you know, he's difficult to deal with. He's lazy. Steve Clifford didn't want to play him in the playoffs because he didn't think he was prepared. And yet somehow the team always seems to play well when he's on the floor.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. I believe his rebounding numbers are still looking good. I didn't look it up offhand. And it's also been encouraging that Marvin Williams is playing better now. He really, really struggled at the beginning of the year, and he's getting closer to respectability.
Yeah, he had a 7 PER, I think, the last time I looked at him. That's up to 11 now, and his season-long percentage, or I'm sorry, not his season-long percentages, but over the last 15 games, 7.4 net rating for Marvin. That's the best on the team. And his shooting percentage is back to pretty good. 38% on threes. He had been really just couldn't hit a three. 46% overall from the field. And so getting something out of those guys, yeah, if they have an injury, especially if Zeller goes down, especially, they could be in big trouble, I think. But they're holding on, and I think as long as there aren't any injuries, they've been playing well lately. They are certainly a big favorite for that four seed. Where are we at with Kemba Walker? He had an unbelievable first month or so of the season, dropped off a little bit since then, but still playing well.
He's still an all-star, but you know that a whole ridiculous stretch at the beginning, like, we appreciated it for what it was, but it wasn't just, oh, this is a new Kemba Walker, this is just all of a sudden he's that guy. I mean, we're saying this is kind of like what we said with Isaiah Thomas, like maybe he did turn over a new leaf. He has had some good games recently. I mean, he dropped 37 on the Cavs on that New Year's Eve game, but I still think that this is closer to the equilibrium for Kemba Walker, and that's still an incredibly useful player.
Yeah, there are three key things that have regressed for him. First of all, he's just shooting less threes and less free throws since December 1st. And, you know, I think his free throw attempts per game are down from about 5 to 3.5. And then his three-pointers as well, he's taking about 1.5 less per game. He had been shooting in the 40s on threes, still very respectable 38% since December 1st. And so even if he just settles in at 38%, that really changes everything for him, you know, that compared to the guy that he was a couple of years ago. So he still can be pretty solid. I think it'll be interesting to see if they get into the playoffs, whether teams are going to really be able to take him away. Nick Batum is the other guy who can kind of create things on this team, but he is shooting a not very robust 39%, a little more efficient because he takes a lot of threes, but just really has stopped getting to the rim at all. He's taking, I think, less than 10% of his shots in the basket area.
Not exactly what you want to see with a guy who just signed a big long-term contract, but that's the way it goes.
Speaking of not exactly what you want to see, the Chicago Bulls.
Bulls, 16-18, 3-8 since the last time we did this, 18th in offense, 13th in defense, 40% chance of making the playoffs. They were, for reference, 64% on 538 2 weeks ago, 88% 3 weeks ago, now projected to be 11th in the East with 37 wins.
I preached caution with them when they were playing well because, number one, they were shooting unsustainably well on threes. And I think also teams have now figured them out that they just cannot shoot. Like, if you watch, I watched that Bucks game where they blew them out in the fourth quarter. That game, they just got destroyed whenever Butler was off the floor. Had no answer for Giannis and Jabari in transition. And obviously those guys were really good too. But one of the things that really was killing the offense in that game was, we'll get to the Rondo thing. Rondo didn't really play in that one. But teams are also just not guarding Dwayne Wade either, right? Like, if Wade is on the weak side, all those like ghost cuts that Wade used to get when he was playing with LeBron, those really worked because there was a lot lot more space around him still to where you had to guard him. Now teams are just not guarding Wade at all. If there's Jimmy Butler trying to do something on the strong side, run a pick and roll, for example, they will just bring Wade's man all the way into the lane to gum up the works with the roll man, and then they'll throw it to Wade, and Wade will miss a three. Or, I mean, he's taking a few more threes, shooting 31% overall during the season, which is a lot better than the 15% that he shot last year, but he's still not a quality three-point shooter. Whatever magic he found in the playoffs and the first like three games of this year has long worn off. Let's get to the Rondo situation rundown. Do you have it handy, or do you want me to do it?
I think I could do it. So Rondo, he's had various kind of issues and conflicts with the coaching staff, including that issue with Jim Boylan earlier in the year. And Hoiberg made the decision to start Michael Carter-Williams over Rondo, not due to injury, but due to actually wanting to start Michael Carter-Williams over him. Rondo, as he does at almost everything, bristled at it, basically said, if you're not going to have a role for me, then I don't want to be here. And
I wouldn't say that, actually. I think that in all the reporting has indicated that he actually has been good about it, that he hasn't been throwing a tantrum about it. You know, he had some comments about, hey, you know, if this is going to continue, then I have this stature in the league, I might want to move somewhere else. But he said, no, I'm not going to actually throw a fit, was his quote, and all the reporting says he's continued to be professional about it. And Carter Williams really doesn't help much more than Rondo. He can at least finish a little bit at the rim, and he'll play more defense. He's more switchable. And that was the biggest thing that was vexing about Rondo, was just how many times he would just like not even try on like switches or, you know, one-on-one situations. Even like, it was at the point where you felt like Rondo, who is famously averse to contact because he hates shooting free throws himself, he seemed to be thinking that like if he committed a foul, he would be the one to have to shoot the free throws. Like, it was getting to that point where he would just back off and like let guys score on switch situations. So and his transition defense was terrible also. So I thought it was a good move, but going to Carter Williams is not going to really solve things. And while they may look at Rondo again as a backup, they're going with Grant and Carter Williams. I think there seems to be an acknowledgement now that, hey, this team is not who they were the first month of the year, you know, a 4 or 5 seed in the East, where Rondo doesn't have a future here. And so you might as well take a look at younger players who might be better now anyway.
They also need to evaluate particularly Carter Williams, because he's going to be a restricted free agent at the end of the year. So now that he's back and healthy, that they owe it to themselves to figure that out. Maybe they only gave up Tony Snell for it, and it didn't look like Snell was a big part of their future, but Carter Williams is an asset. He's a potential answer for their question, maybe not the starter question, but at least part of the backups if it's at the right price. They owe it to that. And I mentioned this before, but thinking about how this could go with Rondo, my instinct is that the $3 million partial guarantee for next year could really loom large with this, because a lot of teams would be interested conceivably in a flyer on him, but whether they have cap space or not.
Hasn't he run out of gas now? Like, who could actually still think that this guy is going to help you at this point, even as a backup?
Doc Rivers, maybe?
I mean, they have guys. Like, yeah, they got Raymond Felton. They got, I think it would be...
He'd help the Nets, but that's just because the Nets have no one.
Yeah, I mean, maybe like as a backup, like the Hawks, if they... I mean, I think Delaney is better than him. At least he can shoot a shot, but...
I'd floated the Magic, but both their point guards are playing better than him.
Washington, perhaps, in a buyout situation, if they... Trey Burke has had more success playing off the ball than on, but yeah, I mean, nobody's taking on that contract. That's for
exactly
sure.
And that's what I was getting at. Like, even if it was a flyer, like where you threw other expiring contracts at them, you're not going to do it. The only other option would be, depending on how the Bulls are going to approach it, like if they wanted to get somebody who maybe was a little bit better, but the team didn't want them on that contract, maybe that sort of a circumstance. But I don't see that as being likely. I think if it really got bad, a buyout makes the most sense, and there aren't that many great destinations for him.
So to more to the Bulls' macro issues, I mean, they're still starting Butler and Wade and Gibson and Lopez. And those are their four best players. And I think if you really look at what all those four guys have given you this year, Wade's been right about exactly where he was last year in Miami. Now, that performance was highly overrated, what he did last year in Miami. He still is a very high usage rate, 29%, 2% higher than Butler's is. And part of that compiled, of course, when Butler's off the floor. But those lineups really, as with him as the primary creator, haven't worked very well. And he's got, you know, 51% true shooting, high usage. You know, that's about what Wade is at this point. Not going to really wow you defensively, bad in transition defense, etc. But Gibson, he's been giving you more this year than you ever could have hoped. Same thing with Robin Lopez, although he's starting to get exposed a little bit defensively after, I think, after teams saw what the Spurs were able to do with shooting bigs against him. And then Butler has taken even another leap forward as well. He's averaging like 25 a game or whatever it is on very good efficiency. And yet you're still in this situation. And you look at some of the young talent on this team that was supposed to have come through by now. And other than Cristiano Felicio, everyone is disappointed.
McDermott has been strangely, there was a long stretch where he wasn't shooting, which is super weird.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, they're not getting him open either, right?
Right.
I mean, there's, because he's the only shooter, you just stick to him. And then there's, but he has always been, I think, a little bit too focused on trying to get twos instead of threes at times. But yeah, I mean, I think the bigger problem is just that there's no one else who can shoot.
Mirotić hasn't really delivered in the way that we wanted it to. Jerian Grant has been, you know, all right at stretches. And then Denzel Valentine, I think that's one that could end up haunting them. Just, I was it Zach Lowe who talked about that in a piece this week about how Valentine over Juancho in particular, it was somebody wrote about that this weekend that I saw. And I was just like, yep,
well,
that's a good point.
We were just talking about that independently by ourselves of just like how bad that's looking right now. Valentine 14, Juancho 15. But I guess they felt like, hey, we've got Mirotić. He's a core piece. And he played better down the end of last year. He's back down to 30% on threes now after shooting 39% last year. Nonetheless, though, and I mean, the thing about those four guys I mentioned at the beginning is, you know, none of those guys can shoot really, right? Butler is the best three-point shooter out of them. So while those are your four best guys, they don't fit together at all. And you have to get more out of McDermott and Mirotić. And I figured that playing those two guys together is a disaster defensively, but they actually have stopped guys fine. And those guys, McDermott and Mirotić, that is the best two-man lineup involving Mirotić on the team, which is pretty impressive. So maybe those guys do need to play more together, and then you just hope to get some more defense around them, especially during the meat of the game when you're not going to be going after Doug McDermott the way teams would, you know, if you're in the last 5 minutes of the game.
Their net rating is helped by playing together a lot against backups, and they're better than most backups in the league, but it's still important to note, especially when you consider just kind of the weird surrounding talent in Chicago.
I would like to applaud Fred Hoiberg for the first time in like a year and a half, because they always just guard McDermott with the point guard. He actually posted up McDermott on Jason Terry for a bucket in that game against Milwaukee. McDermott was a wonderful post player in college. I think that's like something that, especially on what's becoming an offensive challenge team, that they can actually take advantage of more. And so it was nice to see him just get a post up right under the basket and shoot a layup. Hopefully they'll go to that a little bit more. All right, should we get to Cleveland?
Sure. 25-7, 8-2 since the last time we did this. Fourth in offense, 16th in defense, 62% chance of getting the number one seed in the East, 12% chance of getting the title, which is way too low, and projected to be first in the East with 60 wins, Toronto right on their heels.
Yeah, that's a lot of wins for these guys. And I think the three things that point out, that really pop out to me about what has made them, I think, a much better team this year than last year, at least they're a little bit lower on the depth right now, but all three of their main guys, I think, are playing better than they played in the regular season. One of those is LeBron's three-pointer has come back. He is shooting 38% on threes. And you had some notes about why it is potentially that has improved, or maybe more accurately, how it has improved.
The biggest element to me is that he's doing a lot better on catch and shoot threes, and he's also shooting more of them. Generally speaking, those are the best opportunities that anybody gets. Last year, he shot 1.6 of those a game, and he made 33% of them. This year, he's shooting them 2.3 of them a game, making a 47.8%, which is ridiculous. So that is a major difference. And also, last year he only made about 30% of his open threes. That's over 40% this year. So you don't really know, because 2014-15 was between these 2 years. So this year he's really on the high end of his three-point shooting. Last year was on the low end. I'm expecting that he will eventually fall back to that level. But even if he's at 14-15, that's a whole heck of a lot more versatile versatile as a shooter than we saw last year. And you and I talked about before the playoffs and even during the playoffs that that was going to be a big logistical concern for the Cavaliers.
Yeah, because if you can't go under him now on the pick and roll, that really changes the entire geometry of him as a ball handler. You mentioned his catch and shoot threes are up. That's the next part of this as well, related to that. Kyrie Irving's improved distribution, especially in these last couple of weeks or so, and Brian Windhorst wrote a piece talking to both of them about how he's done a better job of finding LeBron. Kyrie said he watched a lot of film of Wade and even Mo Williams, and Irving talked about how he was able to find LeBron on that cut from the top of the key for that dunk where he hung on the rim against the Warriors. That was basically the old play they used to run with Mo Williams back in LeBron's first Cleveland stint. He definitely has been working on it. I went back and watched all of Irving's assists over these last 3-4 games or so. It was talked about in Windhorst's piece that he's getting into the lane and finding people more. I wouldn't quite put it at that level. I mean, he's had a couple of decent plays to Tristan Thompson in the pick and roll. And he also has succeeded in working in the pick and pop. He'll get the ball on the right side of the floor, get a screen out of like an ice coverage. And then he's had developed the ability to throw a behind the back pass to someone like a Love or Fry and get them an open three. So that's something that he's improved at. Doesn't look that natural at that yet, but he has gotten himself into it. But the biggest difference to me is just that I think he has really embraced moving the ball to the open man quickly. A lot of times when the ball would get to him, it would really stick. And now he just moves it really quickly to find the open guy. And that's been a lot of his assists, is just making the simple play. But there are a lot of simple plays to be made on this team with all this talent and all this shooting.
They also have a lot of players that can convert basic opportunities at a really high level. It's part of why the Cavs are so good offensively, is that they have these guys. Even if you don't give them a great window, they can convert it in some way, shape, or form. And that also ties in with Kevin Love, who has just been excellent this season.
Yeah, he's been good. Let me finish up with Kyrie, though. I had a couple other points with him. One was he's averaging 1.17 points per possession on ISOs, and that's 128 ISOs that he's doing. You know, that we're talking about like 5 ISOs a game. And yeah, I mean, that's still probably a smaller sample size, but that's just crazy efficiency. I mean, the league average on ISOs is 0.8 points per possession. So for him to, and I'm pretty sure if that doesn't lead the league, it's darn close. And certainly the highest combination of ISOs of volume and efficiency in that category. We'll see how that looks at the end of the year, but I mean, the guy can just get his own shot and make it. It's pretty ridiculous. And then he only has 4 shots that he's actually taken as the role man all year. That despite the fact that he runs a lot of those 3-1 pick and rolls with LeBron, and they still, maybe that's just because teams are too worried about him getting open on those plays in a pick and pop three. But it'll be interesting to see if teams really make him shoot that more. I think he can probably make it, but the footwork for a pick and pop is sometimes unfamiliar for guards, and that could be the case. And then you mentioned Love. That's the third component here of why I think they're just so dangerous, the fact that he's shooting this ridiculous volume and over 41% on 3-pointers.
With him, I don't know why, but I totally feel like this is more sustainable. I mean, it is an incredible volume, but he has this capability. Maybe it's not sustainable at this entire rate. His 3-point attempt rate now is actually relatively similar to what it was last year, but they're going in so much more. So his attempt rate last year...
Well, he's taking more field goal attempts overall too.
Right. So he's just a bigger part of their offense, but he shot 36% from 3 last year, and he's at 41.1 right now.
His release looks to have sped up a little bit too. Mm-hmm. That's part of it. I mean, he took 16 3-pointers against the Celtics. Like, it's really pretty incredible what he's been able to do.
And he wasn't forcing it. Those were good looks.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. They really are incredibly difficult to stop. And there's some unbelievable offenses this year in the league, but they're right up there for sure with any of them when they really get it rolling. Let's move on to Detroit momentarily, but first this from Betterment. You can learn more about them at betterment.com/capspace, that URL. Betterment is the largest independent automated investing service out there. They make it easier, more straightforward, and less expensive to invest. One of their useful services is Smart Deposit, which is great for people who freelance. You can set it so if the amount in your checking account exceeds a certain amount, say $5,000, it'll invest it for you automatically. That's just one of the services that they provide with smarter, cutting-edge technology to bring you sophisticated investing and financial advice, all at lower costs than more traditional financial services. More than 150,000 customers choose Betterment's advanced advice algorithms and beautiful user interface to manage over $4 billion of their dollars. If you want to get started with them, let them know that you came from us. They will also give you up to 6 months of no fees at betterment.com/capspace. That's betterment.com/capspace. Investing made better. So man, Detroit, they are 5-10, I believe, since Reggie Jackson returned after avoiding what would have been a miserable loss tonight in Miami. Miami with Dragic, Whiteside, and Winslow all sitting this one out prior to a road trip. Dragic has been out with back spasms. We'll talk more about Miami momentarily. They actually gave up over 60 points in the first half to the skeleton Miami crew, and then finally were able to lock down a little bit and pull out a win. Where are they at in terms of their overall fundamentals?
They are 16-20. 3-7 since the last time we did this, 21st in offense, 7th in defense, and their 46% chance of making the playoffs is down from 72% 2 weeks ago, 91% 3 weeks ago, and 538 has them projected to finish tied for 9th in the East with 38 wins.
We really thought they were going to take off when Reggie came back. That, of course, has not been the case at all. Reggie has the worst net rating of their rotation guys, -7.3 since he returned. Your second worst net rating, Andre Drummond, those are ostensibly your two best players. That is a problem.
It's a major problem, especially when they don't have a ton of options for the other stuff with KCP playing well. You know, if KCP was struggling, you could go through and say, oh, you have that internal improvement. That presumably is part of the logic for why they've tried John Lure in the starting lineup. I don't believe that's going to work, but you can try whatever the heck you want. But
they've played well with him on the floor, to be sure. And it'll be interesting, too. Baines suffered a sprained ankle in this game. He actually is, despite the fact that we've both been pretty critical of him, they've played very well when he's been in as well. But we may actually see now Lure at center, which I think will be an interesting look for them. You know, when I talking to people in their organization, there was some thought that they're going to try him there. And I think we're going to see potentially more of that because you get the impression that they don't believe that Boban is someone who's going to play some rotation minutes for them.
They have two guys they paid a lot of money to in Boban and Lure to try out the spot. I think Lure makes more sense against most teams because he can stretch the floor. It's a big thing of comfortability. You think about a guy like Roy Hibbert who plays backup for Charlotte. There's nothing he can do with John Lure, and most teams don't have enough juice on their second units to make him pay as a defensive center. And I think Lure's not, I don't think of him as terrible on that end. He's just not great, and that's fine for a second unit guy.
One thing that has worked well for them is Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. He is shooting 39% on threes, and he is getting them up there too. He's 72 of 187 so far on the year. He's always been one of the top 20 highest guys in the league in volume these last few years. So you recall that the Pistons were not able to agree with him on an extension, and if he keeps shooting like this all year, that guy's going to get paid.
Bradley Beal is nodding to himself, and everybody else in Detroit is sitting there going, yep, that's how this is going to work.
Well, I mean, and KCP is one of the best defenders of ones and twos in the league, and you know, if you shoot well on threes and you can get out in transition, that's really a very nice player for
you. If you're the Sixers, why wouldn't you make that offer?
Yeah, I think that's probably right. So, but I mean, they're capped out anyway, so it probably won't make much of a difference other than just potentially money out of Tom Gore's pocket. They may even be in the tax with this team, and if this team is not where we hoped that they would be, moving into at least the conversation for the mid-tier of the playoffs in the East, as it appeared that they would be early on this season, then maybe there's going to be a little bit more balking about paying that tax. And that's when, you know, some of the largesse that Van Gundy has had with some of these bench guys, you know, could end up hurting the Pistons.
Not only that, but also the Josh Smith thing is still on their books. and that doesn't help it when you when you're basically paying him and just stretch it out and have that. Is it like $5.4 million off the top of my head, just like lingering on your books?
Yeah, I think that's through like 2019 or something.
Yeah, so that doesn't help either.
No, that's true. You forget about that. Other news: Stanley Johnson was out of the rotation completely. Then he's been back of late. I've been impressed with what I've seen from his defense in snippets. But if the guy can't shoot and he's at 27% on threes, 9 PER, true shooting in the mid-40s, it's not really going to matter what he can do defensively.
I was thinking about that a little bit today when Justice Winslow was on, like, when thinking about him, even though he didn't play in this game. But just the idea of it's so hard to become a positive if you can't do that at a position now. Like, even basically, if you're not a center and you can't shoot, you're going to have to be so good to start.
This is actually a question that a Twitter conversation, and I forget who the user was, but have we reached the point now, like, how many perimeter players are actually good rotation players who can't shoot at all? I mean, who we're talking, maybe Tony Allen, MKG.
Rubio.
Yeah, I mean, but even he, you know, is turning into, I think, more of a liability than he's ever been, too. And I think also just the fact his injuries, he doesn't have the same juice that he did before he messed up his ankle.
Right.
I mean, anyone else come to mind who's like, you know, a perimeter guy who just can't shoot at all, who's actually really an effective rotation player? Where
Giannis has gotten better, I don't think I'd have him in this group anymore.
Yeah, and he plays the four too, basically.
Also true.
Yeah, and he's a guy who has the ball in his hands. I mean, certainly yeah, and he has gotten better. Like, he's been actually was awesome shooting the ball against the Bulls, for example.
Right.
Yeah, I'm
sure
that's
another great piece of the Evan Turner signing. And actually, you posted that video and I was losing it a little bit during that game of the Wolves just not guarding him, and that's exactly why you can't do that anymore, because coaches and players can execute that kind of a philosophy now.
Let's get to the Indiana Pacers. They defeated the Magic today in Vogel Bowl 2, neither of which has particularly lived up to any sort of billing. They've blown out the Magic both
this
times.
This one wasn't as depressing as the first one, though. It was
one was like 88-69 or something.
The first one was the most miserable game of basketball I've seen this season, and this one was at least periodically enjoyable, especially because of their ball movement, which I think we'll probably talk about a little bit. They are 17-18, 5-6 since the last time we did this, 19th in offense, 15th in defense, 56% chance of making the playoffs, tied for 7th in the East with 39 wins, because they're all those teams are just right on each other.
Yeah, they should take a step forward, though, if you look at what their schedule is the next month or so.
Yeah, there's a piece for, I think everybody should read it, that John Schumann does for NBA.com, and he not only looks at the schedule in terms of home games and road games and opponent quality, but really does factor it in together, and according to his calculations and machinations, the Pacers have the easiest schedule in the entire Eastern Conference, and when you look at it, it's very true, because they don't play, I would say the best team they face is either Utah or Houston, whichever one of those two games, and then the rest of it is just a lot of home games against shaky teams and a couple of winnable road games.
Monte Ellis has been out with an injured groin. He has returned but has been coming off the bench. They've been starting Glenn Robinson III in his stead, and the starters with Monte Ellis 315 minutes together, the starters of course being the other ones being Teague, Paul George, Thad Young, and Miles Turner. Those guys together with Ellis, negative 4.2 net rating in 315 minutes. When you throw Glenn Robinson III in for Ellis, this is as of a couple of days ago, positive 5.2 net rating in 138 minutes. And then in even less minutes than that, CJ Miles plus the starters, which would be my preferred starting group, plus 17.2 net rating. And with Rodney Stuckey, only 28 minutes with the starters, but he's plus 12.0. So really, anybody but Ellis. And you're actually doing pretty okay with these Indiana starters.
It makes sense, too. You don't need what Monte Ellis provides on that first unit, and you really need what he doesn't provide.
Yeah, and we'll see. I mean, I don't know that Ellis even really has that much juice either playing on the second unit. You worry about his fit there because they've been getting some decent play out of Aaron Brooks. He was good against Orlando today. But then when Brooks is handling the ball, it's just Ellis in the corner, and you got the same problems again as another guy who not really a good shooter, especially from the three-point line. And then your defense with Ellis and with Aaron Brooks in there isn't going to be too good in the backcourt. Jeff Teague has righted the ship a little bit after a rough start to the season, but still only at 42% overall from the field. field, and more troublingly, 29% from three. I think we recall that he shot it really well last year, especially on catch and shoots. Has not been the case this year. Teams are going under on him. Surprising, actually, this is maybe something to talk about. Of the 19th in offense or 15th in defense, which surprises you more?
15th in defense, because I just didn't think they had the personnel. 19th in offense, I'd say it's a little bit lower than that, but like I think they haven't.
But so you thought the defense would be worse?
Yes.
Interesting. Well, I mean, they still had Paul George. You know, they still have the same coaches from when they were good on defense, other than Vogel. Turner can block some shots, even though, you know, he's young. I think Thad Young is okay. A guy who can switch a little bit. He's not bad on defense. You know, Teague is fine. I mean, and they were third last year, obviously, again, having lost some pieces. And I think this is kind of about right about where I thought they would be. And I'm impressed that they've actually gotten a 15th in defense, because they started the year just so incredibly badly. Did you see Paul George's comments about just like how this year has been? Is that worth discussing at all?
I don't think it's intensely worth discussing, though it was interesting, just in terms of that it seems like it's just so much more of a slog this year. But the reason it's relevant is because Paul George is going to be a free agent next summer, unless he signs an extension next summer, meaning 2018. And any piece of information that makes it appear more or less likely that he will stay with his current location matters, because he's going to be one of the best unrestricted free agents if he hits that market that we've seen in a long time. I mean, he's not in the rarefied air of the Durant, LeBron kind of group, but he's in that next tier to me.
The team success for the Pacers is also going to be very important. And I think even just whether you're kind of playing the way that they were last year, getting to be like a sixth seed or something versus maybe missing the playoffs is rather big for whether he's going to make All-NBA and be eligible for that designated veteran extension or not. And then, of course, whether he stays. So all that plays in, of course. You know, if they're winning, he's more likely to sign the extension. He's also more likely to qualify for the extension. All that stuff really is interrelated. But basically, yeah, for him to say, hey, it's a slog, I got to just like get back to enjoying the process of like being in the gym every day and working. And, you know, it's been kind of difficult this year. That did raise my eyebrows a little bit.
I felt a little bad for him. I don't know if you did too, just because, you know,
yeah, me too, maybe because this team could be awesome. They've just squandered so many resources with their cap space, where they've actually just gotten like guys who just don't help at all. You think of the signings that they've made, the big signings that they've made over the last two summers, and I mean, if they'd just done nothing, they would have been close to better off probably. And certainly just thinking that, hey, we need more guys who can score with the ball in their hands, like that can't be, you know, playing with Monte and Jeff Teague. I don't know that he's like, you know, he's not like a selfish guy, but not someone who's going to just be like diming up Paul George and making his life easier either.
I will say though that Thad Young has done a nice job there this year, and he's shooting 43% from three.
Yes, and actually a higher volume than we've come to know from him as well. He just looks very comfortable shooting the ball. I mean, watching that game today, I've noted it on several occasions that even just shown more versatility with the jump shot, even plays where he's kind of doesn't quite have his feet set or he has to back up, he still looks comfortable firing away, and getting him to space the floor is really useful. Ironically, of course, the whole idea was they wanted to get away from two bigs. That was Frank Vogel's crutch. And now, of course, they're basically playing two bigs off the bench, Big Al and Kevin Serafin together, which is just about the opposite, I think, of what Larry Bird would have had in mind.
Imagine what Paul George would be saying if he was playing with those lineups.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't think there's been enough of a sample to really say how that's doing yet, but I think the idea that, hey, maybe Big Al just is not going to be able to hold up as your center outside of that Charlotte system, as without anybody else around him to protect the rim, maybe that's the case. And, you know, in certain matchups you can get away with it, Orlando being one of them, because they were going with two traditional bigs most of the time here. A few more things I wanted to know about Miles Turner. I thought he had a nice game today in a couple of facets. One was he threw some nice passes. One is a roll man where he caught the ball on the roll, instant touch pass to the corner for Glenn Robinson the third three. I really like that. He had some other times where he moved the ball pretty well. He is definitely not a natural passer, but it's good to see him growing more facile in that area. And then another move that he had that I thought was solid was he had the mismatch in the post at about 14 feet. And usually one of my criticisms of him is he doesn't really back down when he has a mismatch and get a great shot in those situations. He just likes to turn over his right shoulder and shoot the turnaround, which is a accurate shot for him, a quick release, but not the kind of shot you're hoping for with your 7-footer in a mismatch. But he actually pump faked that, got the guy in the air, and was able to get to the foul line. That's something that I think can be effective for him because he does have that solid mid-ranger and the quick release. And that's something that he needs to do, is just get fouled a little bit more often to really help his efficiency and become more of an option creating his own offense.
Seeing that growth is even more encouraging. I lose sight sometimes of how young he is. He'll turn 21 late in this regular season, so he has a lot more room to grow just in terms of sophistication and getting comfortable with the sets and everything like that. And his passing today was the best I've ever seen from him.
Let's get to Miami.
Really?
You had a good question on the guys. We don't have to talk about them on the
road. Oh yeah, yeah. I know, it's just there's situations weird, but 10-25, 3-8 since the last time we did this, 28th in offense, 12th in defense, 2% chance of making the playoffs, projected to be the 13th seed in the East, 27 wins.
Yeah, so they're done now. I think that's pretty clear. I think they're tied for the most losses in the league, I want to say. And they had made a reputation out of playing good teams and losing by 5 every game. I thought the time when I really was like, all right, it's time to start revving up the tank here, was when they just got completely destroyed at home by Oklahoma City, which is a team that you would have hoped they could be competitive against. They, of course, have had all these injuries that have killed them. I still thought that maybe they could have been in the mix with some of these other crappy East teams, the 8th seed, even if the health had been good, even without Bosch. But now they're done, and so what do they do now?
I legitimately don't know, because on a lot of teams you can say, oh, well, you play the young guys, you sit the veterans, you trade the veterans, and we talked about this, I think, on the Twitter show this week, but trading Dragic now might not make the most sense because the teams with needs aren't as prevalent as they will be in the offseason, just depending on their timing. Hassan Whiteside just signed a big contract. He'd probably be cool with a lower minutes workload as long as you're giving him plenty of touches, which actually could in some ways help the tank because he's bad at that.
Yeah.
But in terms of the other parts of it, you know, you could think about Phoenix or various other teams. It's like, oh, you do a youth movement, play your young guys. They're already doing that. Miami's young guys are actually good. Tyler Johnson, Josh Richardson, they're myriad just weird forward guard type of things. Like, it's not that different a team when you do that, and a Spo team is generally going to play hard on defense. So I think you probably just pull the reins in a little bit on Whiteside and Dragic and don't rush good guys back if they get hurt. That's really about it. But I'm going to be fascinated to see whether Pat Riley does that or kind of changes from there for various reasons.
Yeah, I guess they're just not that good. I think shutting down Dragic at any time he has even is remotely injured, I think I could see him just not playing, you know, the last 5 games of the season, something like that. Knee soreness. He's had back spasms that he's missed these last couple of games with here. I do think still it doesn't make sense, as you said, to move him unless you get an overwhelming offer until the summer, when you try to see what you can get in free agency. And then if you strike out and it's really looking like it's going to be a long rebuild, then you move on from Dragic at that point. I think it would be great for them if they could get into the top 5 and start to really think about getting a foundational piece. I mean, you remember Dwayne Wade was drafted number 5 in 2003 when they had somewhat of a similar situation where Alonzo Mourning, I think, missed time with the kidney issue, and they really just, you know, all of their talent that had been part of those late 90s teams aged out, and they just, you know, didn't really have anywhere to go. And that jump started the rebuild extremely quickly with a little bit of cap space. They got Lamar Odom, and then they flipped him for Shaquille O'Neal. So it can improve pretty quickly. I mean, I don't see a guy like Dwayne Wade who's going to be ready to contribute right away. Draftees don't come around like that very often, but that's probably what maybe this offseason will look like for them, assuming that. And then maybe the thought is too that you might consider moving Whiteside. That's the other thing, because with him being 27, I mean, is he an asset? Where is he on your Nene test scale right now?
I was actually, I thought of that during this conversation and was going to say, oh, that would be a good topic for us to do in 2 weeks when we do this 15 and 60. I think that...
All right, well, let's save it for them. We're running
pretty long. Let's save it for them, but I do want to make one other small point. And you kind of alluded to it, but I like to have this as a frame of reference for listeners. For me, when I'm talking about like seeding and all that kind of stuff, for good teams, I focus on losses because that's the part that theoretically, you know, is kind of the differentiator. And then because if teams have played different amount of games, they might have different amount of wins, but the losses are there. And on the converse is true too. So for bad teams, I look at how many wins they have. And so Miami is only two games ahead, let's call it, of the Nets and the Sixers. And considering the Nets and the Sixers both have some pressure to win now, and the Nets and the Sixers actually should be getting better talent-wise if they ever get Simmons back. And they're tied in wins with Dallas and Phoenix, two teams that I expect to be better moving forward than they have been so far, depending on how, unless Phoenix makes a big trade. So they could push... You were saying top five. I'm thinking they might even be able to push into the top three.
Yeah, that would be pretty remarkable. And then their pick next year, if they were still going to be bad, I mean, that'll be really interesting protection. If they don't get anybody this summer, next year, top seven protected, that's going to be like right on the borderline of where they would be.
Top seven is fascinating because they can push at the beginning of the year and fall into it. Like kind of really sticky stuff. Like with top 10, like what the Kings pick is, you kind of get it or you don't. But at seven, you can finesse that.
Yeah. I mean, top seven protected was that was the Warriors Harrison Barnes pick, right?
It was. They did not do a good job of finessing that at the very end.
Let's get to Milwaukee here. Really one of the biggest success stories in the league. A team that we both thought was going to be pretty bad, but they're looking in decent shape right now for the Eastern Conference playoffs.
I'm very happy to be wrong when it's selling low on a team and then they just completely outperform their expectations. 16.
Yeah, there's some teams where I'd like, all right, if I just don't really care aesthetically for their team. Like I always have loved the Bucks aesthetically. Giannis, Jabari, those are like two of the most exciting guys in the league. The Bucks would probably be like number two right now behind the Warriors on my like league pass rank. Just because of the crazy stuff that those two guys are doing. And so I am glad that my best bet under 38 wins is looking like it could be in jeopardy here.
It is still close, as exciting as they've been, but a really encouraging part is that they're eighth in offense, ninth in defense, so that combo is great. 81% chance of making the playoffs right now, projected to be the 5 seed in the East, 43 wins, and so that 81%, they were at 61 2 weeks ago and 34% 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, and early on, they had a very home-heavy schedule, which has still been the case. They have some road games coming up here, but their point differential wasn't that good. They're looking like a little bit of a paper tiger. Also, the fact that, say, teams like Detroit have just completely fallen off has really helped their status as well. The Knicks have lost a few in a row now as well. Indiana, Chicago, another team that's really like has fallen off after a hot start. So a lot of, I think, those increased odds aren't only them playing better, and they do have a very nice net rating. I think they're like 2.5 net rating, even though they're 500. So that helps, but also the fact that the Pistons and Bulls have collapsed has helped their playoff odds immensely.
One basic question that I don't think we have to go into too much depth on it right now, but is Giannis the second best player in the East already?
Well, he and Butler, I think, kind of had that bowl. They've matched up three times in the last month, and the Bucks have blown them out every single game of those, and Giannis has been completely unstoppable. So that certainly helps has helped his case. And when you consider what he's doing, I mean, I think he's been over 20 points now for something like 15 games in a row, something along those lines. And just he's putting up ridiculous lines. He had 7 blocks against the Bulls. I think he had 5 blocks in like the first quarter against Chicago on I think it was Friday night, just doing crazy stuff, and his shooting is starting to come around a little bit. Unstoppable in transition. You know, if you got into the playoffs, I don't know that he would be a better player than maybe like a Paul George or even a Jimmy Butler, because he's not quite the ISO scorer that they are. Those guys are more experienced, they're more lockdown defenders, but certainly for this regular season, I mean, he's been a top 15 player in the league, and maybe you're starting to look at him maybe even as a top 10 guy, which is completely insane considering he wasn't even the best player on his own team last year. It was probably Middleton.
He also, it's a small point with him, but it is notable that his free throw attempt rate is, I think it's the highest of his career. It's right in line with his rookie year, which was a different sample for a couple different reasons.
Yeah, and his usage again is way higher too.
Way higher.
You know, Omer Asik has a high free throw attempt rate because every time he gets the ball down low, he gets fouled before he can shoot it, but that's a very rare occurrence. When you're both increasing your free throw rate and your usage is way higher, that's when you're really doing something.
Giannis also is shooting the best percentage there in his career. So he was at 72% last year, 78.8 now. If that's close to a new, not a new baseline, but if that's close to like where he is now, it's a huge part of his value. And as we talked about before, you know, still not the greatest three-point shooter, but he does basically everything else.
Jabari Parker, for his part, insanely low turnover rate for him, only 7%. For when you consider a guy with his usage, his responsibilities, that's crazy. Jabari only 21 years old, shooting three-pointers at both a rate and efficiency beyond anyone's wildest dreams, taking 20% of his shots from down there, 37%, and a lot of those are actually some pretty tough attempts too. He has been very, very confident shooting from out there. Also, even has gotten much better defensively. They are essentially having Giannis be the guy who protects the rim, and Jabari has to be the guy who's gonna be your lockdown guy in the perimeter, and he's guarded Jimmy Butler in that Bulls game. I mean, he's not like locking guys down, but I think it's looking like, surprisingly enough, because Jabari is a guy with more kind of power forward size, he's not really a shot blocker. He doesn't have the facility for that. He is a much worse defensive rebounder than Giannis as well. So in a lot of ways, that makes sense. And then those guys can always switch, of course, if there's any 3-4 action involved.
It's not surprising when you consider their personnel, but the Bucks have been absolute killers in transition. They're third in the league in frequency. 16.5% of their possessions per the synergy stats are in transition, and they're fifth in points per possession. So they get there a lot, only behind the Rockets and the Warriors, and they are very effective in those spots.
Let's move on to the New York Knicks. 16-17, a mere 2-7 over their last few games, as they again have been felled by injuries. Where are they at in terms of the rest of their fundamentals?
16th in offense, 25th in defense, 49% chance the playoffs dropped off. That's dropped off from over almost 60% a couple weeks ago. Projected to be tied for 9th in the East with 38 wins.
Yeah, and the Knicks, their big problem is their net rating is like -2.8 or something like that. Like, it's definitely below -2.5, and for a team, and they also have like I think 2 wins over above 500 teams, which is not very good. It just shows that at least they're able to beat the teams that they in theory are supposed to beat, but just have not looked very good at all when they're playing against any real teams. The injury bug has hit. Carmelo Anthony left his last game with a knee injury. Don't know if he's going to play on Monday against the Magic. That is his left knee, the one that he had surgery on a couple of years ago. He was able to play the game before. Then he tried to warm up. It just stayed stiff and he had to exit. Courtney Lee has had a wrist injury after an ankle injury. When he's out, you're getting big time Sasha Vujicic minutes. That's no good for you either. Lance Thomas still struggling with the plantar fasciitis. Rose missed time with back spasms. KP also missed time as well with, I believe, knee soreness that kind of showed up. He wasn't able to get loose. He, I think, is going to be questionable for the next game. Not looking good right now for the Knicks, I think we could see them on the verge of what's going to be a tough stretch here, just due to the health.
The health, and they're another theory of the team issue, because they just don't have enough personnel, in my opinion, to be a solid defensive team, and they have offensive capabilities, but those players don't really feed as much off each other, so it's hard for them to really rise above not their current station, but just their overall kind of spot in the middle of this morass.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, Porzingis was a sore Achilles.
Yes.
Carmelo was the knee, and Kyle O'Quinn didn't play against the Rockets either, due to flu-like symptoms, and that's how you end up giving up, you know, 53 points, 15 assists, and 15 rebounds to James Harden, and $129 to the Rockets. I wanted to think about here, it's becoming very clear that this team is going to scrape into the playoffs, maybe. They don't have any depth. Noah is just the worst contract in the league. The hope for me was that if Noah could give you what he did back in the day defensively, and you also had Porzingis, that defensive front court could actually be decent. As you mentioned, they're, you know, 26th in defense or whatever. I think we can foreclose on that. I think we can foreclose on Noah ever being a quality defensive anchor, and really we can't talk about him as part of the future other than just a salary. Now, what's the next step here? None of these guys really are part of the future except for Kristaps Porzingis. What type of team are you trying to build around Kristaps Porzingis going forward?
You want to have a good pick and roll point guard first and foremost. You want to have somebody who can, ideally, who can shoot that pull-up shot but also make the correct pass to Kristaps when he's available. You want to have enough spacing everywhere else that people can't help off of it, but you also want to have enough competent defenders that you can be league average or better.
And it's just going to be very difficult for them to improve defensively in the long term. And you also have the question of whether Porzingis is a four or a five. Do you build your team around that? Are you going to get, how much money can you really put into the center position? I think because Noah is a sunk cost, you almost really have to play Porzingis at the five and just hope to get in some more wings, because you're not going to spend more money on a center. You've also got O'Quinn under contract at a pretty cheap rate. You've got Hernan Gomez. I think you got to just get by with those guys in the future and just hope to fill in with some better defense on the wing. And maybe that would be, all right, we get a little bit more of a caretaker point guard, we move on from Rose and try to find someone who can defend on the wing. And then we've got Lee and this guy, will have Porzingis at center or on Melo for the time being. But the problem is there really are not any good defenders. You know, maybe like just you could get a Tabo Sefolosha type of guy on a shorter deal, you know, an older guy as a bridge to move on. But yeah, I mean, at some point, when is the transition going to happen to Porzingis being the centerpiece when Noah and Carmelo and, you know, presumably if Rose leaves, it's really difficult to see what that bridge is going to be. And you're hamstrung certainly by the fact that, you know, 20% of your salary cap or so, maybe a little bit less than that, is tied up in a center who can't play.
They also have this situation with Melo that he has a no trade clause. So you have, not only does that hurt you in terms of moving him, but also it hurts you in terms of the return in case he decides that he wants to be traded.
Quickly, Derrick Rose has the best net rating on the team. I think that would have been a surprise to many of the people who believed that Rose was done. He's been okay this year. I think he really has. One thing that is a little concerning is he is just not a very good passer. When he's on the floor, only 51% of their buckets do they assist. When he's off the floor, it goes up to a more normal 59%. Part of that's because he plays with Melo as well, but you would hope that just simply by being able to play pick and pop with Porzingis that he could get some more assists, and that the team as a whole could get some more assists, get some more advantage situations than they do.
I wonder how that would be if Noah could finish anything anymore.
Yeah, that might help a little bit to actually have like a role man or even a guy in the dunker spot who you could throw an alley-oop to. I think there's Dirk Nowitzki, for example, who's forever the analog for Porzingis offensively. He played with a lot of guys who were really good dunkers at that center spot, and that really helped them. Having someone who can't finish there is really a problem. Let's move on to the Orlando Magic.
15-20, 5-5 since the last time we did this. They've been 500 in both of the last 15 and 60 stretches. They were 4-4 last time. 29th in offense, 19th in defense, 18% chance of making the playoffs, projected to be the 12th seed in the East with 34 wins.
That, of course, a disappointment even for the relatively modest expectations that Vegas had for them, which I think was 37. I actually had the over just thinking that they would defend better. And the biggest thing that's happened in their season is they made this starting lineup change. Initially, it was DJ Augustin starting, and along with Jeff Green, Aaron Gordon, when Green, I think, was injured, moved back into the starting lineup. He's had a couple of really big games. He has remained in the starting lineup. Sometimes Peyton will start the second half, and very often Augustin just won't come back in. It's a very odd situation of just, you know, anomaly who's a star, but they need Augustin shooting with that first group. They also took Vucevic out of the starting lineup, put in Biyombo. They are 9-10 since that starting lineup change. They had been 6-10 before that. Still a negative 3.6 net rating despite the 9-10 record. So that's, you would expect that record to be a lot worse with that kind of a net rating. And most disturbing, 108.8 defensive rating since that starting lineup change. You'd think that would help the defense to be playing Biyombo and Ibaka together more in the starting lineup. Well, the Congo line is allowing a 109.4 defensive rating on the season when those two guys play together. So the defense has been the most disappointing thing about this team. They had a stretch where they looked pretty good defensively, but yeah, 19th in defense overall for this squad. And I think we all thought they'd be right around 29th in offense, but we thought this should be a top 10 defense, and they're just nowhere close to that level right now.
Think back to that game against the Spurs when they looked so good, got that nice win, and they haven't played horribly overall, but they haven't really given a reason to show that much optimism in the near term, have a lot of stuff that they need to figure out. And a big part of that is, A, are they contenders this year? So, because if they're not, then what is Serge Ibaka thinking? He's an unrestricted free agent. We talked about Millsap. I think it makes far more sense to trade Ibaka than Millsap, just in the sense that at least Millsap has a history with Atlanta. And then the other big part is figuring out what they have in Aaron Gordon.
Yeah. Well, of course, there are the job issues issues. The idea of trading Ibaka would be a significant loss of face. But I mean, I think just for the long-term health of the franchise, moving on from Ibaka as soon as possible before he gets exposed as even, you know, having more of an athletic decline, not really being a key part of what we hoped would be an excellent defense here is important. Yeah, you mentioned Aaron Gordon's jump shot. He's had some games, a couple of monster games where he's just been on fire. Looks more comfortable taking it, which is always a good sign, you know, where he's even catching on the move, stepping back behind the three-point line. Release looks smoother. Still can't hit a free throw, which is never a great sign for becoming some sort of a really good jump shooter. And is shooting off the dribble, you know, from the long two area outside the paint, 34%, which is still well below the league average, which is about 40%, and his three-pointer is still not great either, you know, in the low 30s, but at least he's getting the volume up a little bit, looking a little bit more comfortable taking it. I think he's definitely shown some progress so far this year, but in general hasn't really been able to get what we hope to see from him at the rim.
He's a four. I think that's really what I've taken from this, not only in terms of his shooting, but his off the dribble game. And so
I will say this, I mean, I think that this has been good for him. This is good development. Sure. That if he goes back to the four, he could really be a force. But I mean, they had plays today where, like, they're trying to ISO him on Paul George. Like, come on. Like, that's not going to work. And again, if this season were all about development, I would completely understand what they're doing with Gordon. But that, of course, has not been the case really for the Magic. This is a jobs are on the line, we got to win type of season.
It is. Ready to move on to the Sixers?
Yes.
They are 8-24, 2-6 since the last time we did this. An unsurprising 30th in offense, 21st in defense, and now they're projected to tie with the Nets for last in the East with 22 wins.
They did have a rousing win at Denver on Friday, a game that I really enjoyed. Joel Embiid dominated down the stretch of that game to really take them home. I think they even came back down the end of that one. He also had a really enjoyable matchup with DeMarcus Cousins, where he had some amusing comments, or Cousins did, saying, you know, this guy could be the best big man in the league once I retire. And Embiid said, nah, you know, I'm planning on being it before DeMarcus retires. What I wanted to ask you, though, is we talk about all the assets that they have, all these young guys, etc., but who on this team is really going to be a part of what they're trying to do, other than Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid, to really say, hey, this is a guy who's even going to be, we feel good about being a rotation player once this team is ready to actually compete for something?
Not much, because their veteran guys are going to be free agents by that point. And that even includes Robert Covington, because he'll be an unrestricted free agent due to his
contract. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I guess he will be unrestricted. Yeah, you imagine that they'll have his bird rights, that they'll probably try to keep him around. I feel comfortable talking about him as part of the core. Neither of the centers, though, Okafor or Noel. Maybe Rashawn Holmes is just your backup center. You could feel pretty good about him, I think, as your long-term backup center. What do you think of that?
I like him. He's certainly worth a flyer at that spot, and he's cheap for right now, so you can do that. I still have some hope for Timothy Luwawu-Cabarrot. I like him, but he's just going to take some time, just like anybody who's kind of had his path.
I mean, that's a guy who is drafted number 24 in a pretty weak draft, I'm not penciling him in, I guess.
No, we'll put it I'm not way. Either. So, yeah, that's about the list.
Could Stauskas be like your two off the bench?
Could be. You're going to have
to. Yeah, but we're not feeling great about that.
No, and like maybe maybe McConnell's a backup one. You know, he can be, I like him more as a third point guard, but as a second, maybe he can get there.
Šarić.
Oh, yeah.
Your backup power forward.
Yeah, I think he's in your rotation somewhere. I don't know exactly where it is, but he's in there. I like him a lot. And then also, I mean, they have a wonderful bevy of future assets, which is part of the reason why we're so high on their potential, because their draft assets, I would say, are better than anybody else in the league.
Yeah, and what made me think of this question is when you say, oh, why wouldn't the Sixers throw a max offer at KCP? He would just be perfect for what they're trying to do as a guy who can defend ones and twos. I mean, even you could just have him play the one and have Simmons be the one on offense. That would be awesome, actually. But I mean, the Pistons are going to match, so it doesn't matter. But
yeah, and that also ties in with the crazy pipe dream I talked about with Sam Vecenie on Real Jam Radio of playing Lonzo Ball. Like, if they got Lonzo and played him at the two, if you had him and KCP, it'd be awesome.
Yeah, I think there are the outlines of a roster getting together. It's just they don't have anybody at the one and the two right now who is part of what the solution is. But I would just love for them to just say, all right, you know, we're just going to get 3-and-D guys as like our one and our two. I mean, I guess you need one other guy who can attack off the dribble, but hopefully that guy can be shooting guard size, and then you can have Ben Simmons doing most of the work there. Gerald Henderson, we've seen him miss games periodically with hip soreness. He also just doesn't play that many minutes, and I think he has that congenital hip defect. I think I recall hearing years ago, and has had, I think, two hip surgeries at this point in his career. And so we wondered why can this guy only get a 2-year deal with the second year non-guaranteed for $18 million? And I think those health concerns are the reason.
Certainly fair. Anything else you think we need? Oh, one other thing I want to mention with them. Their transition defense is still horrible. I mean, it's probably one of the worst transition defenses in the league. And so, you know, there are a lot of reasons why a team could do that. They're young and all this sort of stuff. But they're also in the bottom 10 in offensive rebound rate. And that's untenable. And there are a lot of different reasons why it can happen. But at a certain point, there needs to be accountability, whether it's for the players, the coaching staff, or both.
Yeah. And young teams usually are pretty bad in transition D. They're not as good at communicating, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I agree. I still, other than take losses with a relative smile and that 1 year where they were 12th in defense, you're still hard pressed to come up with something that Brett Brown has done well as a coach. And it'll be, if I had to guess, this is not based on any inside info, but just you have to think that this summer, if things don't improve once Simmons comes back, that it'll probably be curtains for him, and that the Colangelos will want to get their guy in there.
That could be a really nice job.
Yeah, no, that's true. Let's talk about Nerlens Noel too. Back in the rotation now after he was out of it following the complaint that he had about only playing 8 minutes, but with Embiid missing time on back-to-backs, Okafor suffering an injury, Rashawn Holmes in the concussion protocol, he's actually getting some minutes. There's talk that he and Embiid could play together. He and Embiid are buddies, and Embiid has said that they could play together. I'm skeptical of that. I mean, you might as well try it before Simmons comes back. You don't have anything else to do. But really, we've wondered why it is that a team hasn't made a real good offer for Nerlens yet, and what they would be willing to do. And I, you know, just in terms of his upside for a team that doesn't have really any way to improve defensively, and Portland being a perfect example of this, although, you know, paying his next contract, I think it's really more about that, paying his next contract, because, you know, Tim Bontemps has a phrase that he always uses where it's like, all right, if you wonder why it is that this guy doesn't have any value in the around the league, well, maybe it's like a personality issue, and perhaps that's what it is with Nerlens. I don't have any specific inside info on that, but the idea that he, and I hopefully it's not this idea that he, you know, was carping about minutes. I actually completely understand that, and I have no problem with players trying to get to a better situation, but maybe that's part of why a team doesn't want to commit not only, you know, something along the lines of 2 first-round picks, but then also what's going to be an $18 to $20 million a year contract going forward. And then you throw in the health issues as well. I still think it could be worth the attempt for a team that's just kind of, you know, capped out and doesn't have any other way to improve other than maybe getting this guy because he's just so talented. But it's highly risky in a number of facets to acquire him.
And when you think about the idea that part of what a GM is trying to do, good, bad, or indifferent, is keep their own job, getting Nerlens Noel for the price that the Sixers are going to be willing to move him for could get you fired in a year or two.
Yeah, maybe that's right. But and I think it's just, is it one first round pick or is it going to be two? You know, that I think is what it's ultimately the question is going to be. Or, you know, a first round pick and a prospect or something. Like, is it the 20th pick in the draft enough of a return? It's just the kind of the problem for the Sixers is if they hold on to him, they don't really have much of an end game.
I'm just going to throw a random thought at you. If it doesn't require any of their premium assets, like meaning one of the Nets picks, how would you feel about him on the Celtics?
Oh, I think he could be very useful there for sure.
I agree, especially if they think they have a shot at somebody like Gordon Hayward. I have to work on the math to make sure that this works, but if they could,
it would be ugly, I think, because the only way, I think they're still short of max space now, even if they dump Olynyk's cap hold, and Nerlens' cap hold is going to be higher than Olynyk's is, especially with the new rules now increasing the percentages. So I think they would be very hard pressed, even just to hold his cap hold, to get anywhere close to a max free agent. So I think there'd definitely be some concern there. I mean, And maybe it's more even that they make the offer to him. You know, it could be even be that more than it is that they acquire him now. But it would be nice to have him now.
Mm-hmm.
Toronto, we saw them in person last week. They got destroyed in the first quarter, 42-17. Had a very impressive comeback for what had been one of the best offenses, or the best offense of all time coming into that game. Then they lost the next night in Phoenix, put up only like 91 points against what's a miserable Suns defense. So that really hurt their odds because of the projection systems obviously expected them to beat Phoenix. They lost, and they are now no longer favored to be the number one seed. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, they've fallen all the way to 34% chance on 538 of that. 23-10, 7-3 since last time did this. First in offense, 14th in defense, 10% title odds. So their title odds are actually pretty close to Cleveland's, which I think are too low. Projected to be second in the East with 58 wins. Cleveland is at 60. And I don't want to make this a Warriors thing, but there is this interesting kind of parallel with it that teams that played the Warriors on the front end of a back-to-back are 2-8 in that second game, and a couple of those have been some of the weirdest losses of the season. And there is not enough of a sample to talk about it, but I do think there was some of that. I didn't watch a ton of that Raptors Suns game, but it did feel like there was some hangover in it.
What did you think seeing this Raptors team in person? Anything pop out to you?
I liked how much fight they had. You know, that was a game where they got completely outclassed. Like, that was one of the more impressive displays I've seen in person or on TV this year, and they just got worked and then came back at the beginning of the second quarter, just kept on grinding, kept on battling, and did a much better job starters versus starters in the third quarter. I don't think it made me more impressed with them like as a playoff team or how well they can do against the best of the best, but they're going to win a lot of regular season games because of the combinations of players and because of how much quality they're getting from their depth, pieces, which is unusual in the league right now.
Few things that popped out to me. One is, and forgive me if we've discussed this before on the show, but they have actually started Siakam at the four in the first half, and then they've actually gone to Patterson to start most of the second halves of late. I still think they should just be starting Patterson, and their start with Siakam and Valanciunas against the Warriors and against a lot of teams just is not good enough. And in the playoffs, they're going to need their best guy out there. I don't see Sullinger, who actually was moving around pretty well before the game. And maybe this January return date could be realistic for him now, but I still don't think he helps them. I mean, you think about the teams that these guys are trying to beat, right? Boston, Cleveland, the Warriors, if they somehow made it to the finals. And Valanciunas is bad enough. I don't know that Bebe even can play against the shooting that those teams have in the front court. They really just don't quite have the juice, I think, defensively. And while I do believe in this team's offense in the regular season, I think they'll take a little bit of a step back. They're a very versatile offense. They have proven pretty stoppable in the playoffs. I think DeRozan is someone who, while he has gotten better, is still, if you have a really good wing defender, you can shut him down. If he's not getting his BS fouls, he can get shut down. And then Lowry, I mean, it's time to acknowledge, as he nears his 31st birthday here, what an incredible season he's having. 24.2 PR at the moment. He's shooting 45% on three-pointers, almost 70% at the rim. Really just an incredible shooting performance. He's been shooting so well off the dribble too. He now is clearly, again, having a better season even than DeRozan, who is still doing well. He's not kept up the same level that he was at the first month of the year, but it's just incredible what Lowry's doing. And perhaps actually we may have been giving him short shrift in that discussion about whether Giannis is the best player in the East or not. Because he has just been killing it lately.
That's a great point. He's been awesome and is a part of one of the most successful lineups that is in the NBA right now, that Lowry plus bench unit that still doesn't need a name but could have a name. And I am openly skeptical about how he will age, but he's awesome now and they have to keep
skeptical about how he would age 2 years ago and he just keeps getting
absolutely
better. Completely ridiculous.
Absolutely. And you know that happens.
He is now Lowry is now fourth in the entire league in RPM.
Wow.
And he was a top 10 guy last year. It's really, now again, he has not been anywhere close to this player in the playoffs, which is a major problem. And who knows whether that was injuries, who knows whether it's just a psychological thing, bad luck, nobody knows. But pretty remarkable what he's been able to do in the regular season. If we're talking about the regular season, I think, yeah, it is pretty clear to me. Well, I guess Giannis is number two overall in the entire league in RPM too right now. So maybe the East doesn't suck as much as we thought.
One thing that makes me a little bit queasy with him this year is, so his career high in true shooting percentage was 57.8, which was last year. He's at 64.4 right now. Like, that's when you start pushing on your career highs at age 30, it gets a little bit worrisome. And if he takes, you know, the step back that is both expected and totally justified, he's still great, but it's a little bit different.
Yeah, and one of his highlights too, I mean, I agree with you, he can't keep this up. We keep saying that about him, but yeah, it seems pretty unlikely that he can keep shooting 45% on threes with the type of attempts that he takes. We would be negligent in not discussing the 25-point fourth quarter he had to basically win a game against Utah on his own at Utah. That was one of the best quarters of the season, probably the best quarter of the season that anyone has had against an outstanding defense. I mean, even, and then at the end of the game too, he iced it by throwing this ridiculous alley-oop to Noguera from like 30 feet away, like 2 inches over the outstretched hand of Rudy Gobert and his 9'7" standing reach to put the Utah out of its misery in that game. He's just been outstanding, and a guy that I also really love watching him play. I mean, just the fight that he has, the way he goes after loose balls in that Warriors game. The Warriors were screwing up. They kept running all their plays to get Lowry switched onto a bigger guy. And really, you should do that against DeRozan or Terrence Ross, because neither of those guys has any fight to him against bigger guys. But they kept going after Lowry, and Lowry was just stopping Kevin Durant like over and over again down the end of that Warriors game.
I absolutely love watching Kyle Lowry. I hope they can get a power forward through a trade. I'm a little bit skeptical that's going to happen just because of their assets, but I hope it does.
All right. End of the line here. Washington Wizards.
Sunny days are here again for the Wizards, at least compared to where they were before. 16-16, 7-3 since the last time we did this. 12th in offense, 20th in defense, and their 58% chance of making the playoffs is up from 32% 2 weeks ago and 26% 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, they had that miserable start. I forget exactly what the record was, but they're like, 3-8 or 3-10 or something to start the season. I've really been enjoying watching this team play to
Me
the
too.
Extent that I have. Wall and Gortat have a wonderful pick and roll chemistry. I mean, they have this play where Gortat will get into the lane on the pick and roll and just kind of slow down a little bit. Wall will throw it at like pretty much behind him, but Gortat will slow up. The pass will go like just past the big, but Gortat will reach back, grab it, and then bring it forward and lay it in. And just, he really helps create that passing angle for Wall. Brad Beal is having by far the best season of his career. I think you would even have to argue that he is living up to his contract. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, as long as he can stay on the floor.
Yes, and that of course is the other shoe that could drop very easily with injury. I mean, Gortat with Jan Mahimi out again now, he's playing 36 minutes a game at age 32. That's not really something that I think is that sustainable. I mean, he's had games where he's played 43 minutes. They have been doing a little bit better with guys like Jason Smith. The bench is not getting killed quite as badly any longer. Trey Burke actually had 27 points against Brooklyn. Granted, Brooklyn is terrible, but Burke is actually getting closer to the acceptable backup point guard that we hoped. 54% true shooting, which is above league average, but not a guy who really distributes, and he's been really bad even creating his own offense in the pick and roll. One of the worst higher volume guys in the league among backup point guards. And then he has been very effective spotting up more off the ball though, and he's just been able to scrape out enough to where over these last 10-15 games or so, when they've been playing well, his net rating has been around zero, and that's for a bench guy on the Wizards. That's actually not too bad at all.
That's actually quite good. But
another thing,
go ahead.
No, I just talked for a long time. I'm tired of talking.
It's not a surprise, but it's a little bit frustrating that like it's taken this time to kind of figure out what Trey Burke is. But at least now they have enough time to figure this out and just and use what's good about him. And even if a player doesn't fit exactly what you've traded for him, and they didn't give up anything to get him, even the only thing they gave up was the opportunity to sign someone else, basically, that they can maximize it for these remaining 40 something games and enjoy it and see if they can get something that is worth using your restricted rights on, because his cap hold doesn't matter when you're the Wizards and have no flexibility.
I also wanted to talk about how their offense could be even better. I think, is 12th in offense, is that like a positive surprise for you? Is that better than you thought they might be?
Considering how bad their second unit has been, Yeah, but I think their starting unit could be awesome offensively, and Otto Porter has been excellent this year so far.
Yeah, he's shooting it pretty well from downtown. Still would like to see a little bit more volume from him, but in terms of his development, shooting the ball, it's been about what you would have hoped to see. I don't really know how they get much better defensively. Gortat is a below-average defensive center at this point. Markieff Morris, he can defend every once in a while when he's motivated, but overall hasn't been that great in his career. Porter is probably is below average for like your stopper guy. Beal is okay. Wall is not the defender that he was a couple years ago, despite the fact that he's having a career year offensively. Maybe if they get Mahimi back, but I'm starting to become quite skeptical that that's going to happen with the knee issues that he's had on both knees now. I'm not sure how much they can get better, but I mean, this is a team that's looked very unstoppable at times lately, and they could get even better if they get a little more production out of their pick and roll role men. Gortat, for all of his brilliance and chemistry with Wall, when he's actually asked to finish, he's below average as a role man, and it's not doing a ton of pick and pops either. Usually that'll be what decreases your efficiency on that. And then Markieff Morris, 14th percentile in the league, 0.77 points per possession, only 52 points on his 67 possessions as a role man. Jason Smith, actually, after having such a miserable start to the season, has been better. He actually has been more effective now on his pick and pops, ranking in the 70th percentile, 53 possessions there for him as the role man. But if they could get a little bit more out of Gortat and Morris in the pick and roll, then I think this team really becomes difficult to deal with because they have been shooting the ball so well from outside.
We will probably do the next East 15 and 60 in 2 weeks, and one of the parts that I'm most excited about is seeing if any team can break out of this group and become probably the clear-cut fifth best team in the East. Maybe not in terms of final outcome. We don't know where that's going to go. And I think Washington has a decent shot at being that team because they have a talented group. They don't need Jan Mahimi. It'd certainly be great to have him considering he's better than their other options. And if Washington can do that, and also, of course, if any teams fall off the table, if, you know, this group that goes for all the way from Atlanta and Washington down to Orlando, if that group sheds any teams over the next 2 weeks, or if we're going to have to wait until the last month before the trade deadline to figure out what the heck's going on.
Yeah, to me, it seems like really once you get below the Hornets, who will count as in, you've got seven teams fighting for four spots. Bucks, Hawks, Wizards, Pacers, Knicks, Pistons, and Bulls. I think I like those first four teams that I named, Bucks, Hawks, Wizards, and Pacers, to be the last four seeds in the East. Knicks, I'm not as much of a believer in. I think the Pistons have plenty of potential. If they can get it together here, I would like them to move into that group and maybe displace the Pacers, Wizards, or Hawks, especially because the Wizards, you know, could suffer injuries at any time, and that could torpedo their season. They've been pretty healthy so far, other than Mahimi. But is there any, do you see it any differently as far as this race for the last four seeds in the East?
All other things equal, I'd be a little bit higher on the Hawks. I just like them. I think they're a well-coached team, but their offense scares me, and the possibility of them trading Millsap, because there's very little chance that something like that makes them better in the short term.
That's true. I mean, I think the Knicks and Bulls are the two teams that I like the least out of that group. I think they to me are the ones that I say you're probably not going to have much of a chance as well. And even, you know, the Bulls have been pretty healthy so far too, with their main guys. What happens when Wade has to miss time, or God forbid Butler, or someone happens to Taj Gibson or Robin Lopez? Like, they've got plenty of guys who have struggled with their health too, and they're also just playing so poorly lately. But yeah, I mean, the Knicks, it's just the Pistons are the biggest mystery to me. Like, I feel like they should be a lot better, and just since Reggie Jackson came back, they haven't been. And how much of that is Reggie and how much of it is psychological? And it's really difficult to say at this point.
I think we're about done here. Do you think so?
Yeah, that was a marathon per usual, but we hadn't done this, so we took a week off on the 15 and 60. If you're interested in advertising on this podcast, my email address is in my Twitter bio, natebduncan@gmail.com. Podcast advertising is pretty awesome. I think you get a lot more bang for your buck than radio or whatever other methods you're going to be doing, because it's kind of a podcast listeners actually pay attention, especially I hope on this podcast. Also, don't forget about the Twitter NBA show this week, Thursday night. Again, we'll be doing that. Follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Danny is Danny LaRue, and we will probably be back, I want to say, Tuesday night with our next episode. We'll let this one marinate for a day or so, and we'll talk to you all then.